This time, Eric was producing to kill. Contempt had been the undercurrent in his "I hate" rants. Now he made it explicit. Morons had nerve to judge him, he said. To call him crazy just for envisioning mass murder? Empty, vacuous morons standing in judgment? If you got a problem with my thoughts, come tell me and I'll kill you, he posted. Dead people don't argue. God damn it, I am pissed. As Eric embraced murder, Dylan retreated. After the arrest, he had the one brief outburst in his journal, and then he dropped all mention of it for nearly a year. Dylan still fretted about this toilet earth, but his focus shifted dramatically toward love. Love. It had been prominent from the first page of his journal, but now, a year in, it grew overwhelming. He emblazoned entire pages with 10-inch hearts, surrounded by choirs of smaller, fluttering hearts. Eric had no use for love. Sex? Maybe. He shared none of Dylan's desires for truth, beauty, or ethereal love. Eric's only internal struggle concerned which stupid bastard was more deserving of his wrath. Eric's dreams changed after his arrest. Human extinction was still his aim, but for the first time, he made the leap from observer to enforcer. I will rig up explosives all over a town and detonate each one of them at will after I mow down a whole fucking area full of you snotty-ass, rich, motherfucking, high-strung, godlike, attitude-having, worthless pieces of shit-whores, he wrote. He posted this openly on his website. I don't care if I live or die in the shootout, he wrote. All I want to do is kill and injure as many of you pricks as I can. It was too much for Dylan. Kill? Everything? Apparently not. He made a stunning move behind Eric's back. He told. He told the worst possible person, Brooks Brown. Brooks knew about the petty vandalism, and his parents saw Eric as a young criminal, but they had no idea how serious it was. On the way to class, Dylan handed Brooks a scrap of paper. Just one line was written on it, a web address. I think you should take a look at this tonight, Dylan said. Okay, anything special? It's Eric's website. You need to see it. And you can't tell Eric I gave it to you. Brooks pulled up the site that night. Eric was threatening to kill people. He threatened to kill Brooks personally in 3 different places. Dylan leaked the URL to Brooks the day before their admission interviews for the diversion program. If Brooks told his parents, and Dylan knew he told Judy everything, the Browns would go straight to the cops, and Eric would be rejected and imprisoned for a felony. Dylan probably would be too. He took that chance. Brooks did tell his mom. Randy and Judy called the cops. Jeffco investigators came out that night. They followed up. They filed reports. But they did not alert the DA's office. Eric and Dylan proceeded into diversion. Only one parent was required at the diversion intake meeting. Tom and Sue Klebold both attended. They considered it important. They filled out an 8-page questionnaire about Dylan. He did the same, and then Andrea Sanchez walked them through the results. The Klebolds were in for a few surprises. Dylan copped to 5 or 6 drunken bouts, starting at age 15. Was not aware of it at all until Andrea Sanchez asked the question a few moments ago, his parents wrote. Apparently, they were unaware his nickname was Vodka. Dylan claimed he had quit drinking. He didn't like the taste and said it wasn't worth it. He had tried pot, too, and rejected it for the same reasons. His parents were stunned about marijuana, too. Tom and Sue were candid. It was the only ethical course. Dylan is introverted and has grown up isolated, they wrote. He is often angry or sullen, and behaviors seem disrespectful to and intolerant of others. They wrote a line about disrespecting authority figures, crossed it out, and then said that teachers had reported that he didn't listen or take correction well. Eric was more cautious. He revealed just enough to appear confessional. He said he had tasted alcohol 3 times, had never gotten drunk, and had given it up for good. Exactly what a parent wanted to hear, It was vintage Eric, more believable than abstinence and reassuring to boot. He had faced the temptation already, and the danger had passed. He understood how his parents thought, and in no time he'd read Andrea Sanchez. In their first meeting, he turned an admission into a virtue. He lied about pot, too. He claimed he had no interest. The alcohol admission gave the claim credence. Wayne and Kathy both attended their session as well. Their surprise came in the mental health section. On a checklist of 30 potential problem areas, they marked 3 boxes: anger, depression, and suicidal thoughts. Eric had told them about those 3, and he discussed them with Dr. Albert. He was getting help. Everyone agreed the Zoloft was helping too. It was common for an adolescent to check several boxes. Eric picked 14. He marked virtually everything related to distrust or aggression. He checked jealousy, anxiety, suspiciousness, authority figures, temper, racing thoughts, obsessive thoughts, mood swings, and disorganized thoughts. He skipped suicidal thoughts, but he checked homicidal thoughts. Wayne and Kathy worried about Eric suppressing his anger. They admitted that he would blow up now and then, lashing out verbally or hitting an object. He never tried it in front of his dad, but they'd gotten reports back from work and school. It didn't happen often, but they were concerned. Eric responded well to discipline. They had controlled his behavior, but how could they contain his moods? When he really got mad, Eric said, he would punch a wall. He had thought about suicide, but never seriously, and mostly out of anger. He got angry all the time, he said, at almost anything he didn't like. Eric was seething as he scrawled out his answers, and he practically told them so on the form. The nerve of these lowlifes judging him. He explained how he hated fools telling him what to do. In the interview, he apparently directed his anger at other fools. They fell for it. Eric would howl about it later. The partial confession was his favorite con of all. He could turn over half his cards and still pull off the bluff. He posted his actual thoughts about the legal system on his website at around the same time. My belief is that if I say something, it goes. I am the law. If you don't like it, you die. He described going to some random downtown area in some big city and blowing up and shooting up everything he could. He assured us he would feel no remorse, no sorrow, no shame. Yet there he sat, submitting. He bent to their will. He filled out their degrading form. Laughing on the inside was insufficient. He would make them pay. Sanchez worried about the boy's failure to accept full responsibility. Eric was sticking to his story that the break-in was Dylan's fault. Dylan thought the whole thing was a little overblown. Sanchez noted her reservations, but recommended them for enrollment. The final decision was up to the court. A week later, on March 25th, Eric and Dylan stood before Jeffco magistrate John DeVita during a joint hearing. Their father stood beside them. That impressed DeVita. Most of the juveniles appeared alone or with just a mom. Dads were a good sign, and these dads appeared to be taking control of the situation. DeVita was also impressed by the punishments they had imposed. "Good for you, Dad," he said. "It sounds to me like you've got the circumstances under control." "This has been a rather traumatic experience," Tom Klebold told him. "I think it's probably good, a good experience, that they got caught the first time." "He'd tell you if there were any more?" "Yes. He would, actually." DeVita didn't buy it. "First time out of the box and you get caught?" he asked Eric. "I don't believe it. It's a real rare occurrence when somebody gets caught the first time." But he was impressed by the way the boys presented themselves, dressed up, well-behaved, deferential. "Yes, Your Honor," and "No, Your Honor." They respected the court, and it showed. DeVita pegged Dylan as well. The B's and C's on his report card were a joke. "I bet you're an A student," DeVita said, "if you put the brain power to the paperwork." DeVita gave them a lecture, then he approved them for diversion. This pair was going to do just fine, he thought. 14 months later, after the murders, DeVita lamented how convincing the boys had been. What's mind-boggling is the amount of deception, he said, the ease of their deception, the coolness of their deception. Judy and Randy Brown kept calling the cops. They were sure Brooks was in danger. Their other son was so scared he slept with a baseball bat. After 2 weeks of their pestering, the case was bumped up to investigator John Hicks, who met with Judy. On March 31st, he sat down with two other investigators, Mike Guerra and Glenn Grove, to discuss it. The situation looked pretty bad. Bad enough for investigator Guerra to type out a 2-page affidavit for a search warrant, duly sworn upon oath. Guerra did good work. In the affidavit, he dramatically outlined all the crucial elements of the case against this kid. He detailed the specificity of Eric's plans, his methods, and his ordinance. He quoted liberally from Eric's website to provide proof. But most important, Guerra drew the connection to physical evidence. A bomb matching those in Eric's descriptions had recently been discovered near his home. The Harris house was to be searched for any literature, notes, or physical material related to the construction of explosives, as well as all email correspondence, presumably to include the website. The affidavit was convincing. It was filed. It was not signed or taken before a judge. It was not acted upon in any way. A plausible explanation for inaction was never provided. Years later, one official said Guerra was drawn away to another case, and when he returned, the affidavit, as written, lacked the timeliness required to take it to a judge. The Browns said that Investigator Hicks also knew about Eric's arrest for the van break-in. There was no indication that he, or anyone from the sheriff's department, ever relayed their damning evidence about Eric to the diversion officers. Magistrate DeVita was provided no indication before he approved them for the program. Senior officials from the sheriff's department, the DA's office, and the criminal court were unaware of one another's actions concerning Eric. But Eric apparently knew what they were all up to. Eric got wind that the Browns were onto him, so he took his website down for a while. There is no indication he ever learned of Dylan's betrayal. There is no sign that he suspected. Eric was getting serious about his plans now, and he would not risk posting anything about them on the web again. He pulled out a spiral notebook and began a journal. For the next year, he would record his progress toward the attack and thoroughly explain his motives. 38. Martyr. She's in the Martyrs Hall of Fame, Cassie's pastor proclaimed at her funeral. That was not hyperbole. A noted religious scholar predicted Cassie could become the first officially designated Protestant martyr since the 16th century. This is really quite extraordinary, he said. The flames of martyrdom are being fanned by these various preachers who apparently have embellished the story as they have told it. It takes on a life of its own. In the Weekly Standard, J. Bottom compared her to the third century martyrs Perpetua and Felicity, and the tales of the thousands of early Christians who went joyously to their deaths in the Roman Colosseums. And the response felt like the Great Awakening of the 18th century, Bottom said. He foresaw a generation of kids rising up to recast our cultural landscape. He later described a national change of heart, trembling on the cusp of breaking forth. It's an ever-widening faith that the whole pornographic, violent, anarchic disaster of popular American culture will soon be swept away. It was a great story. It gave Brad and Misty tremendous relief. They were due. The enemy had taken on their little girl before, and in the first round, the enemy had won. It had been possession, pure and simple. That's how Misty saw it. The enemy had crept into her house a decade earlier, but remained hidden until the winter of 1996. She discovered his presence just before Christmas. She had just quit her job as a financial analyst at Lockheed Martin in order to be a better full-time mom. It was a tough transition, and Misty went looking for a Bible for inspiration. She found one in Cassie's room, and she also discovered a stack of letters. They were disturbing. The letters documented a vigorous correspondence between Cassie and a close friend. The friend bitched about a teacher and then suggested, "Want to help me murder her?" The pages were filled with hardcore sex talk, occult imagery, and magic spells. They hammered a persistent refrain, "Kill your parents. Make those scumbags pay for your suffering. Murder is the answer to all of your problems." Misty found only the friends' letters, but they suggested a receptive audience. Blood cocktails and vampires appeared throughout in descriptions and illustrations. A teacher was shown stabbed with butcher knives, lying in her own blood. Figures labeled Ma and Pa were hung by their intestines. Bloody daggers were lodged in their chests. A gravestone was inscribed, "Pa and Ma Bernal." "My guts are hungry for that weird stuff," one letter said. "I fucking need to kill myself. We need to murder your parents. School is a fucking bitch. Kill me with your parents, then kill yourself so you don't go to jail." Misty called Brad, then the sheriff. They waited for Cassie to come home. First, Cassie tried to downplay the letters. Then she got angry. She hated them, she said. She admitted to writing letters in kind. She screamed. She said she would run away. She threatened to kill herself. Reverend Dave McPherson, the youth pastor at West Bowles, counseled Brad and Misty to get tough. "Cut her phone, lock the door, pull her out of school," he said. "Don't let her out of the house without supervision." That's what they did. They transferred Cassie to a private school. They let her leave the house only for youth group at the church. A bitter struggle followed. "She despised us at first," Reverend McPherson said. "She would threaten to run away and launch into wild, graphic screaming fits." "I'm going to kill myself," Brad recalled her yelling. "Do you want to watch me? I'll do it. Just watch. I'll kill myself. I'll put a knife right here, right through my chest." Cassie cut her wrists and bludgeoned her skull. She would lock herself in the bathroom and bash her head against the sink counter. Alone in her bedroom, she beat it against the wall. With her family, she was sullen and spoke in monosyllables. "There is no hope for that girl," Reverend McPherson thought. "Not our kind of hope." Cassie described the ordeal in a notebook her parents found after her death. "I cannot explain in words how much I hurt. I didn't know how to deal with this hurt, so I physically hurt myself. Thoughts of suicide obsessed me for days, but I was too frightened to actually do it, so I compromised by scratching my hands and wrists with a sharp metal file until I bled. It only hurt for the first couple minutes, then I went numb. Afterwards, however, it stung very badly, which I thought I deserved anyway." Suddenly, one night 3 months later, Cassie shook the enemy free. It was after sunset at a youth group praise and worship service in the Rocky Mountains. Cassie got caught up in the music and suddenly broke down crying. She blubbered hysterically to a friend who couldn't make out half of what she said. When Misty picked her up after the retreat, Cassie rushed up, hugged her, and said, "Mom, I've changed. I've totally changed." Brad and Misty were skeptical, but the change took. She left an angry, vengeful, bitter young girl and came back brand new, Reverend Kirsten said. After the conversion, Cassie attended youth ministry enthusiastically, sported a WWJD bracelet, and volunteered for a program that helped ex-convicts in Denver. The following fall, Brad and Misty allowed her to transfer to Columbine High, but she struggled with social pressures right up to her last days. She did not attend prom that last weekend. She did not believe that kids liked her. The day before Cassie was killed, the leaders of her youth group gathered for a staff meeting. One of the items on the agenda was, "How do we get Cassie to fit in better?" Brad and Misty Bernal were forthcoming about Cassie's history. A few weeks after the massacre, it was widely reported in the media. By then, two other martyr stories had surfaced. Valene Schnur's account was remarkably similar to Cassie's, except for the chronology and the outcome. Val was shot before her exchange about God. Dylan pointed his shotgun under her table and fired several rapid bursts, killing Laura Townsend and injuring Val and another girl. Val was riddled with shotgun pellets up and down her arms and torso. Dylan walked away. Val dropped to her knees, then her hands. Blood was streaming out of 34 separate wounds. Oh my God, don't let me die, she prayed. Dylan turned around. This was too rich. God? Do you believe in God? She wavered. Maybe she should have kept her mouth shut. No, she would rather say it. Yes, I believe in God. Why? Because I believe, and my parents brought me up that way. Dylan reloaded, but something distracted him. He walked off. Val crawled for shelter. Once she made it out, Val was loaded into an ambulance, transported to St. Anthony's, and rushed into surgery. Her parents, Mark and Sherry, were waiting for her when she came to. Val started blurting out what had happened almost immediately. She made a full recovery, and her story never varied. Numerous witnesses corroborated her account. Val's story emerged at the same time as Cassie's, the afternoon of the attack. It took a week longer to reach the media. It never caused much of a ripple there. If the timing had been different, Val might have been an evangelical hero, the brave girl who felt the brunt of a shotgun blast and still stood up for her Redeemer. She proclaimed her faith, and he saved her. What a message of hope that would have been. And the hero would have been alive to spread the good news. It didn't work out that way. Val was seen more often as a usurper. People thought I was a copycat, she said. They thought I was just following the bandwagon. A lot of people didn't believe my story. The bigger Cassie's fame grew, the more Val was rejected. An evangelical youth rally was particularly disturbing. She told her story to a crowd gathered to honor Cassie and Rachel Scott. She got a very cold reception. No one really comes out and says that never happened, she said. They just skirt around the issue, like they ask, are you sure that's how it happened? Or, could your faith really be that strong? Val's parents were supportive, but it wore on her. You know, it gets frustrating, she said. Because you know in your heart where you were and what you said, and then people doubt you, and that's what bothers me the most. Cassie's fame grew. Reverend Kirsten embarked on a national speaking tour to spread the good news. Pack as many onto the ark as possible, he said. By summer's end, the local youth group Revival Generation had blossomed from a few local chapters to an organization with offices in all 50 states. The organizer put on national touring shows with Columbine High survivors. Cassie's name sent teenage girls storming to the stage. Fame could be intoxicating. Brad and Misty were already celebrities in their world, blessed parents of the martyr. They resisted the temptation and carried on as humbly as before. For some time, Brad Bernal had been a greeter at Sunday worship services at West Bowles. He returned to the volunteer role almost immediately after Cassie's funeral. He offered a smile with each handshake. The smiles looked sincere, but his pain bled through. In early May, the church brought in a grief expert and conducted a group counseling session open to anyone in the struggling community. Misty arrived first. Brad would be a little late, she said. He was having a really bad day. He had not gone into Cassie's room since she died, but tonight he was going in there alone. Brad showed up, shaken. He downplayed his trouble and offered to help. Misty did the same. Emily Wyant watched in disbelief as the story mushroomed. Why are they saying that? She asked her mother. Emily had been under the table with Cassie. They were facing each other. Emily was looking into Cassie's eyes when Eric fired his shotgun. Emily knew exactly what had happened. Emily was supposed to be in science class when the shooting happened. But they had a test scheduled, and because she had missed class the day before, she wasn't ready. Her teacher sent her down to the library to look over her notes. She pulled up a seat by the window at a table with just one girl, Cassie Bernal, who was studying Macbeth. They heard some commotion outside, and some kids came to the window to check it out, but it dissipated. Emily stood up for a look, saw a kid running across the soccer field, and sat down, returning to her notes. A few minutes later, Patty Nielsen ran in screaming and ordered everyone to get down. Cassie and Emily got under the table and tried to barricade themselves in by pulling some chairs around their tiny perimeter. That made them feel a little safer. Cassie crouched by the window side of the table, looking in toward the room, and Emily got down at the other end, facing Cassie 2 feet away. They could keep in contact with each other that way and collectively maintain a view of the whole room. The chairs created a lot of blind spots, but the girls were not about to move them. That was the only protection they had. Emily heard shots coming from down the hallway, one at a time, not in bursts. They were getting closer. The doors opened. She heard them come in. They were shooting, talking back and forth, and shouting stuff like, "Who wants to be killed next?" Emily looked over her shoulder to watch. She saw a kid near the counter jump or go down. The killers walked around a lot, taunting and shooting, and Emily got a good look at them. She had never noticed them before she was a sophomore, but was sure she could pick them out again if she ever saw them again. The girls whispered back and forth, dear God, why is this happening?" Cassie asked. "I just want to go home." "I know," Emily answered. "We all want to get out of here." Between exchanges, Cassie prayed very quietly. Eric and Dylan passed by several times, but Emily never expected one of them to come under the table and shoot. Eric stopped at their table. At Cassie's end, Emily could see his legs and his boots, pointing directly at the right side of Cassie's face. Cassie didn't turn. Emily didn't have to. She was facing perpendicular to Eric's stance, so she could look straight at Cassie and see Eric just to her left at the same time. Eric slammed his hand on the table, then squatted halfway down for a look. "Peek-a-boo," he said. Eric poked his shotgun under the table rim as he came down. He didn't pause long or even stoop down far enough for Emily to see his face. She saw the sawed-off gun barrel. The opening was huge. She looked into Cassie's brown eyes. Cassie was still praying. There was no time for words between them. Eric shot Cassie in the head. Everything was muffled then. The blast was so loud, it temporarily blew out most of Emily's hearing. The fire alarm had been unbearably loud, but now she could barely hear it. She could see the light flashing out in the hallway. Eric's legs turned. Bree Pasquale was sitting there, right out in the open a few steps away, beside the next table over. It had been jammed with kids when she got there. She couldn't fit, so she sat down next to it on the floor. Bree was a bit farther from Cassie than Emily, the next closest person, but she had a wider view. She had also seen Eric walk up with the shotgun in his right hand, slap Cassie's tabletop twice with his left, and say, "Peekaboo." He squatted down, balancing on the balls of his feet, still holding onto the tabletop with his free hand. Cassie looked desperate, holding her hands up against the sides of her face. Eric poked the shotgun under and fired. Not a word. Eric was sloppy with that shot, a one-hander in an awkward half-squat. The shotgun kicked back, and the butt nailed him in the face. He broke his nose sometime during the attack, and that's the moment investigators believe it happened. Eric had his back to Bree, so she couldn't see the gun hit his nose. But she watched him yank back on the pump handle and eject the red shell casing. It dropped to the floor. She looked under the table. Cassie was down, blood soaking into the shoulder of her light green shirt. Emily appeared unhurt. Bree was exposed, just a few feet from Eric, but she couldn't take it anymore. She lay down and asked the boy beside her, who was just barely under the table, to hold her hand. He did. Bree was terrified. She did not take her eyes off Eric. He stood up after ejecting the round and turned to face her. He took a step or two toward her, squatted down again, and laid the shotgun across his thighs. Blood was pouring out of his nostrils. "I hit myself in the face," he yelled. He was looking at her, but calling out to Dylan. Eric took hold of the gun again and pointed it in Bree's direction. He waved it back and forth in a sweeping motion. He could shoot anyone he wanted, and it came to rest on her. That's when Dylan's gun went off. Bree heard him laugh and make a joke about what he had done. When she looked back at Eric, he was staring her straight in the face. "Do you want to die?" Eric asked. "No," he asked once more. "No, no, 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 no." She pleaded for him to spare her, and Eric seemed to enjoy that. The exchange went on and on. He kept the gun right to her head the whole time. Don't shoot me, she said. I don't want to die. Finally, Eric let out a big laugh. Everyone is going to die, he told her. Shoot her, Dylan yelled. No, Eric replied. We're going to blow up the school anyway. Then something distracted him. He walked away and continued killing. Bree looked back at Cassie's table. The other girl, Emily, was on her knees now, still facing Cassie's crumpled body, blood everywhere. She looked scared as hell. How could she tell? An investigator asked Bree later. The girl was biting her hand, she said. Bree kept an eye on that girl. When the explosions moved out into the hallway, Bree figured the killers had gone, and she called out to the girl to come join her group. Emily couldn't hear much, so Bree started waving her hands. Emily saw her finally and crawled over. She was not about to stand up. She sat next to Bree and leaned against some bookshelves. Time got blurry for Emily then. Later, she couldn't recall how long she'd sat there. Emily and Bree knew Cassie never got a chance to speak. They gave detailed accounts to investigators. Bree's ran 15 pages, single-spaced, but their police reports would remain sealed for a year and a half. The 911 tape proved conclusively that they were correct. Audio of the murders was played for families, but withheld from the public as too gruesome. Emily and Bree waited for the truth to come out. Emily Wyant was sad. She went to counseling every day. April 20th had been horrible, and now she was saddled with a moral dilemma. She did not want to hurt the Bernals, nor did she want to embarrass herself by shattering Cassie's myth. The whole thing had gotten so big so fast. But by keeping quiet, Emily felt she was contributing to a lie. She was in a tough position, her mother Cindy said later. Emily had told the cops, but they were not sharing much with the media anymore. Definitely not that bombshell. Emily wanted to go public. Her parents were afraid. The martyrdom had turned into a religious movement. Taking that on could be risky. She didn't know the ramifications that could come afterwards, Cindy said. She was just thinking about, I want to tell the truth. Her parents were torn, too. They wanted the truth to come out, but not at the expense of their daughter. Emily had already faced more than any child should. This might be too much. Don't do anything drastic, her parents advised. It's a wonderful memory for Cassie's family, Cindy told her. Let's not aggravate anything. In early May, the phone rang. It was the Rocky Mountain News. Dan Lusiter was one of the best investigative reporters in the city, and he was sorting out exactly what happened in the library. They were tracking down all the library survivors, and most were cooperating. Emily's parents were wary. Her situation was different. The reporter showed the Wyants some of the maps and timelines they were building. The family was impressed. The team seemed conscientious, and their work was thorough and detailed. The family agreed to talk. Emily would tell her story, and the Rocky could quote her, but not identify her by name. We didn't want her to be some national scoundrel, Cindy said. After the interview, Emily was glad she had participated. What a relief to get that off her chest. She waited for the story. The Rocky editors felt they needed more. This could get ugly. They wanted somebody on the record. Emily kept waiting. Her frustration grew. The Rocky Mountain News was waiting, too. They had conducted their investigation and had an incredible story to tell. Much of the public perception about Columbine was wrong. They had the truth. They were going to debunk all myths, including jocks, goths, the TCM, and Cassie's murder. All they needed was a news peg. The story would travel much farther if they timed it right. They were waiting for Jeffco to finish its final report. A week or two before the release, the Rocky planned to stun the public with surprising revelations. It was a good strategy. Misty Bernal had been hit hard. Telling Cassie's story made it more bearable. Someone suggested a book. Reverend McPherson introduced her to an editor at the tiny Christian publisher Plow. Plow had published the book Cassie had been reading before she died, and Misty liked what she had seen of the company. Misty was apprehensive at first. Profiting off Cassie was the last thing on her mind, but she had two terrific stories to tell. Cassie's long fight for spiritual survival would be the primary focus, and her gunpoint proclamation would provide the hook. A deal was struck in late May. It would be called She Said Yes, The Unlikely Martyrdom of Cassie Bernal. The family had no idea the Rocky had discovered that title was untrue. Misty, who had gone back to work at Lockheed Martin as a statistician, would take a leave of absence to write the story. To reduce expenses, Misty agreed to forego an advance in lieu of a higher royalty rate. Plow also agreed to set up a charity in Cassie's name for some of its proceeds. Plow Publishing foresaw its first bestseller. It planned a first printing of 100,000 copies, more than 7 times larger than its previous record. On May 25th, something unexpected happened. Police opened the school up so parents of the library victims could walk through the scene. This served 2 functions. Victims could face the crime scene with their loved ones, and revisiting the room might jar loose memories or clarify confusion. 3 senior investigators stood by to answer questions and observe. Craig Scott, who had initiated the Cassie story, came through with several family members. He stopped where he had hidden and retold his story to his dad. A senior detective listened. Craig had sat extremely close to Cassie, just 1 table away, facing hers. But when he described her murder, he pointed in the opposite direction. It happened at 1 of the 2 tables near the interior, he said, which was exactly where Val had been. When a detective said Cassie had not been in that area, Craig insisted. He pointed to the closest tables to Val's and said, "Well, she was up there then." "No," the detective said. Craig got agitated. "She was somewhere over there," he said. He pointed again toward Val's table. "I know that for a fact." Detectives explained the mistake. Craig got sick. The detective walked him out, and Craig sat down in the empty corridor to collect himself. He apologized for getting ill. He was okay now, but he would wait for his family out there. He was not going back into that library.
This audiobook is continued on Disc 8. Columbine by Dave Cullen. Continued. Disc 8.
Friends of the Bernals said Brad was struggling much more than his wife. It was visible in the way he carried himself into worship on Sunday mornings. Brad looked broken. Misty took great solace in the book she was writing. It gave her purpose. It gave meaning to Cassie's death. Misty had put herself in God's hands, and He had handed her a mission. She would bring His message to a whole new audience. Her book would glorify her daughter and her God. Investigators heard about the book deal. They decided that they owed it to Misty to alert her to the truth. In June, lead investigator Kate Batten and another detective went to see her. Misty described the meeting this way. They said, "Don't stop doing the book. We just wanted to let you know that there are differing accounts coming out of the library." Batten said she encouraged Misty to continue with the book, but without the martyr incident. Cassie's transformational story sounded wonderful. Batten said she made the details of Cassie's murder clear and later played the 911 tape for Brad and Misty. Misty and her Plow editor, Chris Zimmerman, were concerned. They went back to their witnesses. 3 witnesses stuck by the story that it was Cassie. Good enough. The martyr scene was going to be a small part of the book anyway. Misty wanted to focus on Cassie overcoming her own demons. We wanted people to know Cassie was an average teenager who struggled with her weight and worried about boys and wasn't ever a living saint, she said. Misty lived up to her word. That was the book she wrote. She described Cassie as selfish and stubborn on occasion, known to behave like a spoiled 2-year-old. Misty also agreed to run a disclaimer opposite the table of contents. It referred to varying recollections and stated that the precise chronology, including the exact details of Cassie's death, may never be known. Emily Wyant was getting more apprehensive. Her parents continued urging caution. They had a dinner with the Bernals. Brad and Misty asked Emily if she'd heard the exchange. Emily was a bit sheepish about answering, but she said no. Cindy Wyatt felt that Emily had made herself clear, but afterward the Bernals recalled no revelation. Cindy later surmised that they'd taken Emily's response to mean she didn't remember anything. Val Schnoor's family was uneasy, too. Investigators had briefed them on the evidence and told them about Craig Scott's discovery in the library. Val and her parents wondered which was worse, hurting the Bernals or keeping quiet. They also went to dinner with the Bernals. Everyone felt better after that. Brad and Misty seemed sincere and utterly distraught with pain. "So much sadness," Mark Schnoor said. Clearly, the book was Misty's way of healing. The Schnoors were less understanding with the publisher. The editor attended the dinner, and Sherry asked him to slow down. Her husband followed up with an email. "If you go ahead and publish the book, just be careful," he wrote. "There's a lot of conflicting information out there." He suggested that Plow delay publication until the authorities issued their report. Plow declined. In July, the Wall Street Journal ran a prominent story titled "Marketing a Columbine Martyr." The publishing house was obscure, but Zimmerman had called in a team of heavy hitters. For public relations, the firm hired the New York team that had handled Monica Lewinsky's book. Publication was 2 months away, and Misty had already been booked for the Today Show and 2020. The William Morris Agency was shopping the film rights around. A movie was never made. An agent there had sold book club rights to a unit of Random House. He said he was marketing virtually everything you can exploit, and I mean that in a positive way. 39. The Book of God. The screws were tightening. Eric met with Andrea Sanchez to receive his diversion contract. He looked ahead to senior year. He would be consumed writing an apology letter, providing restitution, working off fines, meeting a diversion counselor twice a month, seeing his own shrink, attending bullshit classes like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, maintaining good grades, problem-free employment, and 45 hours of community service. They would periodically hand him a Dixie cup and direct him to a urinal. No more alcohol, no more freedom. Eric's first counseling session and his first drug screening would commence in 8 days. He met with Sanchez on a Wednesday. Thursday, he stewed. Friday, April 10, 1998, he opened a letter-sized spiral notebook and scribbled, "I hate the fucking world." In 1 year and 10 days, he would attack. Eric wrote furiously, filling 2 vicious pages. "People are stupid. I'm not respected. Everyone has their own goddamn opinions on every goddamn thing." At first, the journal sounds like the website, but Fuselier found answers in it. The website was pure rage, no explanation. The journal was explicit. Eric fleshed out his ideas on paper, as well as his personality. Eric had a preposterously grand superiority complex, a revulsion for authority, and an excruciating need for control. "I feel like God," Eric announced. "I am higher than almost anyone in the fucking world in terms of universal intelligence." In time, his superiority would be revealed. In the interim, Eric dubbed his journal "The Book of God." The breadth of his hostility was equally melodramatic. Humans were pathetic fuckheads, too dense to perceive their lifeless existence. We frittered our lives away like automatons, following orders rather than realizing our potential. "Ever wonder why we go to school?" he asked. "It's not too obvious to most of you stupid fucks. But for those who think a little more and deeper, you should realize it is society's way of turning all the young people into good little robots." Human nature was smothered by society. Healthy instincts were smothered by laws. They were training us to be assembly line robots. That's why they lined the school desks up in rows and trained kids to respond to opening and closing bells. The monotonous human assembly line squelched the life out of individual experience. As Eric put it, "More of your human nature blown out your ass." Philosophically, the robotic conception was a rare point of agreement between the killers. Dylan referred often to zombies, too. Both boys described their uniqueness as self-awareness. They could see through the human haze, but Dylan saw his distinction as a lonely curse, and he looked on the zombies compassionately. Dylan yearned for the poor little creatures to break out of their boxes. The problem, as Eric saw it, was natural selection. He had alluded to the concept on his website. Here, he explained relentlessly. Natural selection had failed. Man had intervened. Medicines, vaccines, and special ed programs had conspired to keep the rejects in the human herd. So Eric was surrounded by inferiors who would not shut their freaking mouths. How could he tolerate all the miserable chatter? He had lots of ideas. Nuclear holocaust, biological warfare, imprisoning the species in a giant ultimate doom game. But Eric was also realistic. He couldn't restore the natural order, but he could impose some selection of his own. He would sacrifice himself to accomplish it. "I know I will die soon," he wrote. "So will you, and everyone else." By soon, he meant a year. Eric had a remarkably long time horizon for a 17-year-old contemplating his own death. The lies jumped out at Fuselier. Eric took giddy pleasure in his deceptions. "I lie a lot," he wrote, "almost constant, and to everybody, just to keep my own ass out of the water. Let's see, what are some big lies I have told? Yeah, I stopped smoking, for doing it, not for getting caught. No, I haven't been making more bombs." Eric did not believe in God, but he enjoyed comparing himself to him. Like Dylan, he did so frequently, but not delusionally. They were like God, superior in insight, intelligence, and awareness. Like Zeus, Eric created new rules, angered easily, and punished people in unusual ways. Eric had conviction. Eric had a plan. Eric would get the guns and build the explosives and maim and kill and so much more. They would terrify way beyond their gun blasts. The ultimate weapon was TV. Eric saw the Columbine Commons. He might kill hundreds, but the dead and dismembered meant nothing to him. Bit players, who cared? The performance was not about them. Eric's one-day-only production was about the audience. The irony was, his attack was too good for his victims. It would sail right over their heads. "The majority of the audience won't even understand," Eric lamented. "Too bad. They would feel the power of his hand. If we have figured out the art of time bombs beforehand, we will set hundreds of them around houses, roads, bridges, buildings, and gas stations. It'll be like the L.A. riots, the Oklahoma bombing, World War II, Vietnam, Duke and Doom all mixed together. Maybe we will even start a little rebellion, a revolution, to fuck things up as much as we can. I want to leave a lasting impression on the world." Dr. Fuselier set down the journal. It had taken him about an hour to read, that first time, in the noisy Columbine bandroom, 2 or 3 days after the murders. Now he had a pretty good hunch about what he was dealing with. A psychopath. Part 4. Take Back the School. 40. Psychopath. "I will choose to kill," Eric wrote. Why? His explanations didn't add up. Because we were morons? How would that make a kid kill? To most readers, Eric's rants just sounded nuts. Dr. Fuselier had the opposite reaction. Insanity was marked by mental confusion. Eric Harris expressed cold, rational calculation. Fuselier ticked off Eric's personality traits: charming, callous, cunning, manipulative, comically grandiose, and egocentric, with an appalling failure of empathy. It was like reciting the psychopathy checklist. Fuselier spent the next 12 weeks contesting his theory. That's how he approached a problem: develop a hypothesis, and then search for every scrap of evidence to refute it. Test it against alternate explanations, build the strongest possible case to support them, and see if the hypothesis fails. If it withstands that, It's solid. Psychopathy held. Diagnosis didn't solve the crime, but it laid the foundation. 10 years afterward, Eric still baffled the public, which insisted on assessing his motives through a normal lens. Eric was neither normal nor insane. Psychopathy represents a third category. Psychopathic brains don't function like those in either of the other groups, but they are consistently similar to one another. Eric killed for two reasons: to demonstrate his superiority and to enjoy it. To a psychopath, both motives make sense. Psychopaths are capable of behavior that normal people find not only horrific, but baffling, wrote Dr. Robert Hare, the leading authority on psychopaths. They can torture and mutilate their victims with about the same sense of concern that we feel when we carve a turkey for Thanksgiving dinner. Eric saw humans as chemical compounds with an inflated sense of their own worth. "It's just all nature, chemistry, and math," he wrote. "You die, burn, melt, evaporate, decay." Psychopaths have likely plagued mankind since the beginning, but they are still poorly understood. In the 1800s, as the fledgling field of psychology began classifying mental disorders, one group refused to fit. Every known psychosis was marked by a failure of reasoning or a debilitating ailment, paralyzing fear, hallucinations, voices, phobias, and so on. In 1885, the term psychopath was introduced to describe vicious human predators who were not deranged, delusional, or depressed. They just enjoyed being bad. Psychopaths are distinguished by two characteristics. The first is a ruthless disregard for others. They will defraud, maim, or kill for the most trivial personal gain. The second is an astonishing gift for disguising the first. It's the deception that makes them so dangerous. You never see him coming. It's usually a him. More than 80% are male. Don't look for the oddball creeping you out. Psychopaths don't act like Hannibal Lecter or Norman Bates. They come off like Hugh Grant in his most adorable role. In 1941, Dr. Hervey Cleckley revolutionized the understanding of psychopathy with his book, The Mask of Sanity. Egocentrism and failure of empathy were the underlying drivers, but Cleckley chose his title to reflect the element that trumped those. If psychopaths were merely evil, they would not be a major threat. They wreak so much havoc that they should be obvious. Yet the majority have consistently eluded the law. Cleckley worried about his title metaphor. Psychopathy is not a two-dimensional cover that can be lifted off the face like a Halloween mask. It permeates the offender's personality. Joy, grief, anxiety, or amusement. He can mimic any on cue. He knows the facial expressions, the voice modulation, and the body language. He's not just conning you with his scheme. He's conning you with his life. His entire personality is a fabrication with the purpose of deceiving suckers like you. Psychopaths take great personal pride in their deceptions and extract tremendous joy from them. Lies become the psychopath's occupation, and when the truth will work, they lie for sport. "I like to con people," one of Hare's subjects told the researcher during an extended interview. "I'm conning you right now." Lying for amusement is so profound in psychopaths, it stands out as their signature characteristic. Duping delight, psychologist Paul Ekman dubbed it. Cleckley spent 5 decades refining his research and publishing 4 further editions of The Mask of Sanity. It wasn't until the 1970s that Robert Hare isolated 20 characteristics of the condition and created the psychopathy checklist, the basis for virtually all contemporary research. He also wrote the definitive book on the malady, Without Conscience. The terminology got muckier. Sociopath was introduced in the 1930s, initially as a broader term for antisocial behavior. Eventually, psychopath and sociopath became virtually synonymous. Varying definitions for the latter have led to distinctions by some experts, but these are not uniformly accepted. The primary reason for the competing terms is that each was adopted in different fields. Criminologists and law enforcement personnel prefer psychopath. Sociologists tend towards sociopath. Psychologists and psychiatrists are split, but most experts on the condition use psychopath, and the bulk of the research is based on Hare's checklist. A third term, antisocial personality disorder, or APD, was introduced in the 1970s and remains the only diagnosis included in the latest edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM-4. However, it covers a much broader range of disorders than does psychopath and has been roundly rejected by leading researchers. So, where do psychopaths come from? Researchers are divided, with the majority suggesting a mixed role, nature leading, nurture following. Dr. Hare believes psychopaths are born with a powerful predisposition, which can be exacerbated by abuse or neglect. A correlation exists between psychopaths and unstable homes. The violent upbringing seemed to turn fledgling psychopaths more vicious. But current data suggests those conditions do not cause the psychopathy. They only make a bad situation worse. It also appears that even the best parenting may be no match for a child born to be bad. Symptoms appear so early and so often in stable homes with normal siblings that the condition seems to be inborn. Most parents report having been aware of disturbing signs before the child entered kindergarten. Dr. Hare described a 5-year-old girl repeatedly attempting to flush her kitten down the toilet. "I caught her just as she was about to try again," the mother said. She seemed quite unconcerned, maybe a bit angry, about being found out. When the woman told her husband, the girl calmly denied the whole thing. Shame did not register, neither did fear. Psychopaths are not individuals losing touch with those emotions. They never develop them from the start. Hare created a separate screening device for juveniles and identified hallmarks that appear during the school years: gratuitous lying, indifference to the pain of others, defiance of authority figures, unresponsiveness to reprimands or threatened punishment, petty theft, persistent aggression, cutting classes and breaking curfews, cruelty to animals, early experimentation with sex, and vandalism and setting fires. Eric bragged about 9 of the 10 hallmarks in his journal and on his website, for most of them, relentlessly. Only animal cruelty is missing. At some point, as either a cause or an effect of psychopathy, the psychopath's brain begins processing emotional responses differently. Early in his career, Dr. Hare recognized the anatomical difference. He submitted a paper analyzing the unusual brain waves of psychopaths to a scientific journal, which rejected it with a dismissive letter. "Those EEGs couldn't have come from real people," the editor wrote. Exactly, Hare thought. Psychopaths are that different. Eric Harris baffled the public because we could not conceive of a human with his motives. Even Kate Batten would describe him as a teenager trying to act like an adult. But the angst we associate with teenagers was the least of Eric's drives. His brain was never scanned, but it probably would have shown activity unrecognizable as human to most neurologists. The fundamental nature of a psychopath is a failure to feel. A psychopath's grasp of fear and suffering is particularly weak. Dr. Hare's research team spent decades studying psychopaths in prison populations. They asked one psychopath to describe fear. "When I rob a bank, I notice that the teller shakes or becomes tongue-tied," he said. "One barfed all over the money." He found that puzzling. The researcher pushed him to describe his own fear. How would he feel with the gun pointed at him? The convict said he might hand over the money, get the hell out, or find a way to turn the tables. "Those were responses," the researcher said. "How would you feel?" Feel? Why would he feel? Researchers often compare psychopaths to robots or rogue computers like HAL from 2001, A Space Odyssey, programmed only to satisfy their own objectives. That's the closest approximation of their behavior, but the metaphor lacks nuance. Psychopaths feel something, Eric seemed to show sadness when his dog was sick, and he occasionally felt twinges of regret toward humans, but the signals come through dimly. Cleckley described this as a poverty of emotional range. That's a tricky concept, because psychopaths develop a handful of primitive emotions closely related to their own welfare. Three have been identified: anger, frustration, and rage. Psychopaths erupt with ferocious bouts of anger, which can get them labeled emotional. Look more closely, Cleckley advised. The conviction dawns on those who observe him carefully that here we deal with the readiness of expression rather than a strength of feeling. No love, no grief, not even sorrow, really, or hope or despair about his own future. Psychopaths feel nothing deep, complex, or sustained. The psychopath was prone to vexation, spite, quick and label flashes of quasi-affection, peevish resentment, shallow moods of self-pity, puerile attitudes of vanity, absurd and showy poses of indignation. Cleckley could have been describing Eric Harris's journal. How dare you think that I and you are part of the same species when we are so different, Eric wrote. You aren't human. You are a robot, and if you pissed me off in the past, you will die if I see you. Indignation runs strong in the psychopath. It springs from a staggering ego and sense of superiority. Psychopaths do not feel much, but when they lose patience with inferiors, they can really let it rip. It doesn't go any deeper. Even an earthworm will recoil if you poke it with a stick. A squirrel will exhibit frustration if you tease it by offering a peanut, then repeatedly snatching it back. Psychopaths make it that far up the emotional ladder, but they fall far short of the average golden retriever, which will demonstrate affection, joy, compassion, and empathy for a human in pain. Researchers are still beginning to understand psychopaths, but they believe psychopaths crave the emotional responses they lack. They are nearly always thrill seekers. They love roller coasters and hang gliding, and they seek out high anxiety occupations like ER tech, bond trader, or marine. Crime, danger, impoverishment, death. Any sort of risk will help. They chase new sources of excitement because it is so difficult for them to sustain. They rarely stick with a career. They get bored. Even as career criminals, psychopaths underperform. They lack clear goals and objectives, getting involved in a wide variety of opportunistic offenses rather than specializing the way typical career criminals do, Cleckley wrote. They make careless mistakes and pass up stunning opportunities because they lose interest. They perform spectacularly in short bursts, a few weeks, a few months, a year-long big con, then walk away. Eric spent his young life that way. He should have been a 4.0 student, but collected A's, B's, and C's. He made 1 year-long commitment to NBK, but he had no ambition, zero plans for his life. He was one of the smartest kids in his high school, but apparently never bothered to apply to college. No job prospects either, beyond blackjack. Despite a childhood of soldier fantasies, a military father, and a stated desire for a career in the Marines, Eric made no attempt to enlist. When a recruiter cold called him during the last week of his life, he met the guy, but never returned the call to find out whether he had been accepted. Rare killer psychopaths nearly always get bored with murder, too. When they slit a throat, their pulse races, but it falls just as fast. It stays down. No more joy from cutting throats for a while. That thrill has already been spent. A second, less common approach to the banality of murder seems to be the dyad, murderous pairs who feed off each other. Criminologists have been aware of the dyad phenomenon for decades. Leopold and Loeb, Bonnie and Clyde, the Beltway Snipers of 2002. Because dyads account for only a fraction of mass murders, little research has been conducted on them. We know that the partnerships tend to be asymmetrical. An angry, erratic depressive, and a sadistic psychopath make a combustible pair. The psychopath is in control, of course, but the hot-headed sidekick can sustain his excitement leading up to the big kill. It takes heat and coal to make a tornado, Dr. Fuselier is fond of saying. Eric craved heat, but he couldn't sustain it. Dylan was a volcano. You could never tell when he might erupt. Day after day, for more than a year, Dylan juiced Eric with erratic jolts of excitement. They played the killing out again and again, the cries, the screams, the smell of burning flesh. Eric savored the anticipation. Dr. Hare's EEGs suggested that the psychopathic brain operates differently, but he could not be sure how or why. After Eric's death, a colleague advanced our understanding with a new technology, functional magnetic resonance imaging tests, fMRIs, create a picture of the brain with light indicating active regions. Dr. Kent Keel wired subjects up and showed them a series of flashcards. Half contained emotionally charged words like rape, murder, and cancer. The others were neutral, like rock or doorknob. Normal people found the disturbing words disturbing. The brain's emotional nerve center, called the amygdala, lit up. The psychopathic amygdalae were dark. The emotional flavors that color our days are invisible to psychopaths. Dr. Keel repeated the experiment with pictures, including graphic shots of homicides. Again, psychopaths' amygdalae were unaffected, but the language center activated. They seemed to be analyzing the emotions instead of experiencing them. He responds to events that others find arousing, repulsive, or scary with the words interesting and fascinating, Dr. Hare said. For psychopaths, horror is purely intellectual. Their brains search for words to describe what the rest of us would feel. That fits the profile. Psychopaths react to pain or tragedy by assessing how they can use the situation to manipulate others. So, what's the treatment for psychopathy? Dr. Hare summarized the research on a century of attempts in two words: nothing works. It is the only major mental affliction to elude treatment. And therapy often makes it worse. Unfortunately, programs of this sort merely provide the psychopath with better ways of manipulating, deceiving, and using people, Hare wrote. Individual therapy can be a bonanza, one-on-one training to perfect the performance. These programs are like a finishing school, a psychopath boasted to Dr. Hare's team. They teach you how to put the squeeze on people. Eric was blessed with at least two unintentional coaches: Bob Kriegshauser in the juvenile diversion program, and his psychiatrist, Dr. Albert. Eric was a quick study. The notes in his diversion file document a steady improvement, session by session. Oddly, a large number of psychopaths spontaneously improve around middle age. The phenomenon has been observed for decades, but not explained. Otherwise, psychopaths appear to be lost causes. Within the psychiatric community, that has drawn stiff resistance to diagnosing minors with the condition. But clearly, many juveniles are well on their way. Dr. Keel has a mobile fMRI lab and a research team funded by the University of New Mexico. He mapped about 500 brains at three prison systems in 2008. Because of the skewed sample pool, about 20% met the criteria for psychopathy. He believes that answers about the causes and treatment of psychopathy are coming within reach. While Eric was devising his attack, Dr. Hare was working on a regimen to address his kind. Hare began by re-examining the data on those spontaneous improvers. From adolescence to their 50s, psychopaths showed virtually no change in emotional characteristics, but improved dramatically in antisocial behavior. The inner drives did not change, but their behavior did. Hare believes that these psychopaths might simply be adapting. Fiercely rational, they figured out that prison was not working for them. So Hare proposed using their self-interest to the public advantage. The program he developed accepts that psychopaths will remain egocentric and uncaring for life, but will adhere to rules if it's in their own interest. Convincing them that there are ways they can get what they want without harming others is the key, Hare said. You say to them, most people think with their hearts, not with their heads. And your problem is you think too much with your head. So let's change the problem into an asset. They understand that. While Eric was in high school, a juvenile treatment center in Wisconsin began a program developed independently, but based on that approach. It also addressed the psychopathic drives for instant gratification and control. Subjects were rated every night on adherence to rules and rewarded with extended privileges the next day. The program was not designed specifically for fledgling psychopaths, but it produced significant improvements in that population. A 4-year study published in 2006 concluded that they were 2.7 times less likely to become violent than kids with similar psychopathy scores in other programs. For the first time in the history of psychopathy, a treatment appears to have worked. It awaits replication. Psychopathy experts are cautiously optimistic about coming advances. I believe that within 10 years, we will have a much better perspective on psychopathy than we do now, Dr. Keel said. Ideally, we will be able to help effectively manage the condition. I would not say that there is a cure on the horizon, but I do hope that we can implement effective management strategies. 41. The Parents Group. Fuselier was sure Eric was a psychopath. But the kid had been 16 when he'd hatched the plot, 17 for most of the planning, and barely 18 when he opened fire. There would be resistance to writing Eric off at those ages. 3 months after Columbine, the FBI organized a major summit on school shooters in Leesburg, Virginia. The Bureau assembled some of the world's leading psychologists, including Dr. Hare. Near the end of the conference, Dr. Fuselier stepped up to the microphone and gave a thorough briefing on the minds of the two killers. It looks like Eric Harris was a budding young psychopath, he concluded. The room stirred. A renowned psychiatrist in the front row moved to speak. Here it comes, Fuselier thought. This guy is going to nitpick the assessment to death. I don't think he was a budding young psychopath, the psychiatrist said. What's your objection? I think he was a full-blown psychopath. His colleagues agreed. Eric Harris was textbook. Several of the experts continued studying the Columbine shooters after the summit. Michigan State University psychiatrist Frank Ochberg flew in several times to help guide the mental health team, and every trip doubled as a fact-finding mission. Dr. Ochberg interviewed an assortment of people close to the killers and studied the boys' writings. The problem for the community, and ultimately for Jeffco officials too, was that Fuselier was not permitted to talk to the public. Early on, both local and federal officials were concerned about Jeffco getting overshadowed by the FBI. The Bureau firmly prohibited any of its agents from discussing the case with the media. Jeffco commanders had decided the killer's motives should not be discussed, and the FBI respected that decision. Failure to address the obvious intensified suspicion toward Jeffco. It exacerbated a credibility problem already hovering over the sheriff's department. In addition to why, the public had two pressing questions. Should authorities have seen Columbine coming? And should they have stopped it sooner once the gunfire began? On both those controversial questions, Jeffco had obvious conflicts of interest, and yet they charged ahead. It was a staggering lapse of judgment. Jeffco could have simply isolated the two explosive issues into an independent investigation. It would have been easy enough. They had nearly 100 detectives at their disposal, few of whom worked for Jeffco. The independent investigation didn't seem so obvious in 1999.